For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. Professor Lydia Morawska is a physicist by training, but became involved in the science of air quality and ventilation after the SARS-1 outbreak in early 2003. These days, she is Distinguished Professor in the School of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at QUT in Brisbane. She is also the Director of the International Laboratory for Air Quality and Health, a World Health Organization collaborating centre. Since the start of the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic, Professor Morawska has been advocating for indoor air quality standards and regulation to mitigate against not only COVID-19, but all other respiratory viruses as well. As she says later in this podcast, colds may not kill us, but they make us miserable, so why not try and avoid them if we can, and in the process, save the country about $1 billion a year. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Lydia Morawska as my special guest today. Thank you so much for your time, Lydia. I really appreciate it. You've written this perspective for the MJA, ventilation and indoor air quality. Does Australia have national indoor air standards?
Well, to everybody's surprise, Australia doesn't have any indoor air quality standards. This is very much a situation in basically all the countries.
I wonder why. Do you know why?
The easiest way to respond to the question would be first to compare the situation with indoor air quality standards with outdoor air quality standards.
Yes.
Because, of course, Australia has outdoor air quality standards. There are standards and then there's regulations and there's monitoring for compliance with the standards. All of the states, so every state has a monitoring network, is monitored. And if there's no compliance with the standards, then there are actions taken to mitigate this. But if you think about this, in the whole of Australia, we are talking about 100-something monitoring stations. Every city is 10, 20, depends, monitoring station about. But for monitoring of, for compliance with indoor air quality standards, monitoring would have to take place in every shared room. Now, we are talking about, well, millions of shared rooms. The scale of this in terms of effort and cost is, of course, much bigger. So this is a complexity in terms of monitoring. It doesn't mean that we cannot monitor same parameters in every space. For example, in every space, we monitor temperature. Then it's not a problem. So it is a question what we monitor, but we can monitor parameters in every space. But it would have to be done differently than it is done in outdoors, and not necessarily all the parameters which are monitored or the pollutants which are monitored outdoors will be monitored indoors. One issue is the technology and how to do it. Even bigger issue is who should be responsible for this. Now, there's only one national agency in every state responsible for outdoor air quality. It's called differently, but there's only one. How many agencies are responsible for indoor air quality dependently on the type of building? About schools, Department of Education, we talk about healthcare, Department of Health, we are talking about restaurants and hospitality industry and so on. There's no one government agent responsible for all the buildings. So this is potentially the biggest issue in terms of legislating. On the top of this is also the awareness and value we put for air quality, in particular indoor air quality. Even now, during the pandemic, we still don't pay too much attention what is the quality of indoor air, and there are situations where it's clearly polluted.
What should we be measuring?
In the ideal world, we would measure, on the one hand, we would measure the 6 pollutants for which there's recommendation in the WHO air quality guidelines were announced last year. There are particulate matter, 2 parameters of particulate matter, PM2.5 and PM10, and 4 gaseous pollutants. But this is not possible because the instrumentation for these pollutants, well, it's a monitoring station if we wanted to monitor this. One could say we could use low-cost sensors because all 6 pollutants can be monitored using low-cost sensors. Low-cost sensors is a technology which has been maturing, but we still wouldn't use all 6 of them but the most relevant, and of course, there's a whole discussion what we should use. One of the most important would be to measure particulate matter, PM2.5. This technology, low-cost technology, is reliably established. On the other hand, I wouldn't recommend measuring ozone, because ozone is a secondary pollutant which is formed outdoors. Its penetration indoors is lower than of other pollutants. Any sources of ozone indoors should be controlled as a source, not measured concentration. So this is one aspect, selection of this and in specifically particulate matter. Something very important which is not measured outdoors, and it's not the concern outdoors, are pathogens, what's emitted by humans. These six pollutants, which will not tell us basically anything about human emissions.
Can we measure those pollutants that humans produce?
So the question is what we emit from our nose and mouth. That's we'll focus on this. Firstly, we emit CO2. Every human being alive is emitting CO2 all of the time. And if we are infected, we emit pathogens, which is bacteria or viruses. We can very easily measure concentration of CO2. And this is basically already done in modern buildings. It is not displayed to the occupants. It's not necessarily done in every room. It's sometimes it's done in a plant room for some collection of rooms. These sensors for CO2 are cheap, reliable, so this can be measured. Now, the situation is much more complicated in relation to pathogens. We cannot reliably measure them in real time. And the question is which pathogens we measure. Like we've been through this through the pandemic, that even if with one virus, SARS-CoV-2, how many variants we have. So right now, while we have technologies and methods to detect its presence, but it's not something which we can measure in every room. In this case, it means that we need to rely on a proxy.
Is carbon dioxide a good proxy?
Carbon dioxide is the only and the best proxy. It doesn't mean that carbon dioxide concentration is low or low. It doesn't mean that the risk of infection is eliminated, because these two don't quite go together.
Yes.
For a very infectious pathogen, when very low, small number of the variants is sufficient for infectious, or if people spend sufficiently long time in the interior, even at concentration of carbon dioxide, which are not very high yet, the infection risk would still be elevated. If carbon dioxide concentration is elevated, there's no doubt that the risk of infection is there as well. So in this sense, carbon dioxide is the prime contender for being monitored everywhere and each space and become a standard.
I've seen lots of people on Twitter with carbon dioxide monitors on public transport, for example, going, look at the level of carbon dioxide here. So carbon dioxide is a good indication when the levels are high that your risk of infection is greater?
That's right. If you look at the concentrations high, risk of infection is high. There are two aspects of this, particularly in transport and particularly in situation when air is recirculated. Normally the case on planes. Air is recirculated and recirculated very, very frequently and filtered in the process. So risk of infection is relatively low, very low, unless you are sitting in an immediate proximity to somebody before that dilution can take place. But carbon dioxide, still gets back to the cabin. So concentration in such situations, concentration of carbon dioxide are elevated, but it doesn't mean that the risk of infection is elevated. This is the complication for an individual person monitoring this. But this complication can be worked around. It. We may focus not necessarily on the total concentration in places where it's recirculating, but on the delta. What is the increase above what's the brought into the space? So we are still looking at two parameters. The parameter is what is the delta, which means that this delta is related to infection transmission. And we are still interested what's the total concentration. Well, in many situations and on the planes, for example, I've seen concentration over 2,000 PM. On taxis, which are run on recirculation, I've seen well over 3,000. And one can say it's not a health risk yet. It's a cognition risk. It's not a cognition risk perhaps to the passengers, because if the passengers are a bit lethargic and sleepy, whether on the plane or on the taxi, perhaps this is not a problem. But what always worries me, since I realized the situation, what it does to the cognition and work conditions of the staff, because those people operate under this story.
We know that COVID-19 is airborne. Do Australian governments acknowledge that?
First of all, Australian government, is Australian government, federal government, looking in any of these issues? Australian government puts the responsibility for managing the pandemic to the states. And so Australian government as such had never said anything about being airborne. In letters and petitions we wrote to the federal government, they related to the old recommendation from the WHO stating that it is not airborne. This was at the beginning of the pandemic. Now we are the third year into the pandemic. Different states do different things and are more or less progressed. In my view, the most progressive state is the state of Victoria, where they've done really a lot. It was already last year, more than a year ago, when they announced a big package, financial package, to combat airborne transmission, improving ventilation and so on. So airborne transmission was acknowledged clearly. So it's not only saying we need to improve ventilation without explaining why, but explaining the virus is transmitted through the air, it's airborne, therefore we need to take measures against this. So this is Victoria, but then you take other states, like in Queensland, for example, and nothing of this nature is happening. So there are individual organizations or individuals who are doing something, but the state as such is not openly acknowledge airborne transmission or the need of action.
Do you think all school classrooms, for example, should at least have a HEPA filter or a monitor of carbon dioxide of some kind?
What I've been recommending, the first step in all classrooms, they should be carbon monitor, because I wouldn't go straight away in buying air filters or air purifiers, because we first need to understand what the situation is. Now, most of the schools across Australia, in all states of Australia, are naturally ventilated, which means that they rely on opening windows. The first question is, are the windows indeed openable? Mm-hmm. In some cases, they are not openable, only partially openable. So even if you open them to the extent they can be open, it is still not, there's still not enough ventilation. Then, when the conditions outdoors are problematic, too cold, too hot, too noisy, too polluted, the windows are closed.
Yes.
And this is so then basically there's no ventilation unless there's any unless that building has some other means of ventilation, not through the. But in any case, the first step is to measure CO2 concentration and establish the problem. Of course, doing this during the when there's a full load of students. I've heard that some Department of Education was. We're doing this during the summer break, empty classrooms. Of course, you have no problem in empty classrooms. So measure. If there's a problem, then what needs to be done? And this is very individual, because in some places, still when realizing that there is a problem with ventilation, but still that window can be open most of the time, and so then there's no need for purifier. But if this can be done, then a purifier is necessary.
Yes.
So going through the steps, establishing the problem, how the problem be mitigated, and buying the purifier if that's the only solution.
I'm chatting today with Professor Lydia Morawska, Director of the International Laboratory for Air Quality and Health at QUT. The link to Lydia's co-authored MJA Perspective can be found in the show notes to this podcast. There is also a link there to AusSage's advice about ventilation and air quality. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can find our back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all freely available to play or download. Subscribe to future episodes by searching for Medical Journal of Australia at your favourite podcast platform. We recommend Spotify and Apple Music. Back to our chat. Should office buildings be mandated for having filters and monitors?
What office buildings have, and in general, what modern buildings have, they have the what's called HVAC system, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system.
Yes.
So, in fact, a fraction of the air, often very high fraction of the air, is recirculated. And there are good reasons for recirculation, because if it's not recirculated, then the energy we invested in heating or cooling the spaces is lost. We cannot say, okay, we don't worry about this, because as is, building, the whole building sector as such, consumes over 30% of total energy we humans consume. So this would be a big problem if we said, let's don't worry about air recirculation. We have to consider in the process of air circulation, air goes through the filters and air is filtered. Yes. So the question is that filtration efficient in filtering? It is efficient in relation to many of the pathogens, but again, this should be tested. But it doesn't mean that we should, in addition to what the building has, we should buy HEPA filters. Again, we should check what the station with ventilation. We should make sure that it's efficient. And if this is an old system which doesn't work for whatever reason, only then consider.
Of course, it's not just COVID we're talking about. There are plenty of viral respiratory infections going round. Do we know what the burden of those infections is in Australia?
This is exactly the point. If it was only COVID, I probably wouldn't be putting all my efforts because hopefully we are towards the end of this pandemic. But I've been working in this field since SARS-1. And since SARS-1, realizing how big burden it is on the whole society across the world in Australia. In Australia, it's estimated that indoor air quality in terms of all indoor air problems cost the Australian society annually about $2.6 billion. Those estimates are already old, and estimates did not take into account all the facts. But looking only in lower respiratory infections, this is annually about 1.6 billion in Australia. Of course, we wouldn't, by improving, making ventilation as best as possible, it doesn't mean that we would eliminate all infections, all infection risk in shared space. But let's say that we eliminate only half of this. I think we should be able to eliminate more than half, but only half. So we are still talking about $1 billion. And again, these are costs which don't take all the infections and all the impacts of the infections, like absentees, like if the kids are sick, parents have to stay at home. So the costs are much, much bigger than this. So we are talking about huge costs. Nobody really properly assesses.
We sort of take it for granted that we're all going to get colds and flu and all of that sort of thing, when really we could, as you say, at least halve that with a little bit of effort.
A very interesting situation that perception and not even realization of the risk, kind of shrugging our shoulders against the risk. After all, we are an educated society. We know how infections spread. If we see somebody infected with cold, coughing and sneezing, and that person is our vicinity. So we have enough understanding that saying, okay, the viruses or the pathogens that person has, I will get if I inhale them. And so how we are complete, that was pre-pandemic, it was completely socially acceptable to come to the office coughing, sneezing, and well, it was bravery, I'm working. And nobody seemed to worry about this, and it's completely something I can't explain. And even now, during the pandemic, having gone through the pandemic, we are still kind of indifferent to this. Compared to the situation, okay, so somebody is exhaling this pathogen-containing air, and we know this because that person is coughing and sneezing, and we do nothing. But if let's say I spit it to a public fountain, well, everybody would jump on this. What are you doing? How are you behaving? How come that pollute contaminating with pathogens water attracts this attention and reaction, but not air? This is a sociological phenomenon which I can't understand. You are unlikely going to die of cold, but for a few days you are miserable. It's not pleasant. So if you can avoid this, why not try to?
In your paper, you describe indoor air quality as a regulatory no man's land. What do you mean by that?
Well, that no man's land means that nobody is responsible. The land, in legislative terms, the land doesn't belong to anybody. There's no one government agency which would be responsible for this. So if there are many agencies involved, starting with the Department of Health, the role of this department would be to announce, to clearly state what is the health problem, but then whether it should be the responsibility of each individual department responsible for all the type of the buildings, I don't think so. I think it should be a body which would be responsible just for this between the different government agencies. Yep. So this is that right now no one is responsible.
There's been a lot of talk about the establishment of a National Centres for Disease Control. Would that be a possibility as an agent?
If this body would have mandate over all the buildings.
So Lydia, if you were in charge, if you were the Queen of Australia, what would you do right now to make indoor air cleaner and make us safer?
I would bring the responsible people from all the states, whether this would be, I would be talking about premiers, probably not, but the relevant people from all the states and territories who establish a body between the states, one body responsible for clean indoor air in Australia. Now, we would then need to have a body of experts to help formulating the standard and legislature behind us. Because this is new, this, as I explained, the complexities, and this is very interdisciplinary because we are talking about understanding air pollution, dynamics of air pollution, building engineering, health, and so on. So, and technologies, monitoring technologies, sensing technologies, so we need a body of experts advising the body responsible, government body responsible for establishing the legislation. Based on this, put in place indoor air quality standards and the legislature, which is enforceable for the whole of the country and uniform for the whole country. And then roll in some funds, because of course we will need to do something about this, and it will be a cost which would be much, much lower than the cost which we are already bearing because of all the infections. Keeping in mind that we are not going to change all the buildings from one day to another. No. We are talking about a building stock which we have, which will be in place for the next 10, 20, 30, maybe 40 years. So we cannot expect that all the buildings will be able to comply with the standards as of next year or whenever the standards will be put in place. But we will need to put some transition period, saying that a new building should be designed and have all the provisions, let's say, from next year. But in the existing buildings, we will have to give them some grace period such that there's time to do this.
Would you like to see new buildings be mandated to have these measures in place?
That should happen as soon as possible. The sooner we start, the better. Every week now lost in doing this means buildings which will be in place for the next potentially half a century, which will not be equipped adequately.
Are you seeing much interest from governments in talking to you about this, in making changes?
Well, it depends which governments.
Yes.
Well, as I said, the government in Victoria is very active, and yes, government in Victoria is working on this. I haven't seen any interest from any other state governments, but there are governments in other countries which are very active. For example, it was already in March this year when the White House, the Biden-Harris administration, announced a big indoor air quality challenge, and there's continuous action going into setting this in place, and also in action in many European countries. So it's very difficult to say exactly what's happening because it's a very dynamic situation. Yes. In some places, this is not a comprehensive legislature, but let's say mandating CO2 monitoring, which is a very good start. So yes, things are happening at a different rate, different speed.
Do you wear masks in indoor spaces, in public spaces?
I do wear masks dependently on my assessment of the situation. I do carry a CO2 monitor with me all the time. Also, taking in consideration how much time I spend in the place,
yes,
and whether I'm stationary or moving. So, for example, when I'm going to a large shopping center, I keep going all the time, I'm not stopping anywhere. I know that in a shopping center, there's ventilation. There are very large spaces. It's moving, so I don't wear a mask in shopping centers. But if I'm in transport, whether being in a plane or a bus, particularly if there are more people than two or three people here and there on the bus, yes, yeah, I do wear a mask. In meetings, sometimes when the problem is that sometimes when the meeting starts and I'm looking around, I can't fully assess the ventilation because still the concentration of CO2 is still low because there were no people. Only as the meeting progresses, I can see, is it building up? But if there are sufficient number of people, and it appears to me that the ventilation may not be efficient, yes, I do work.
It's good advice for everybody. And what numbers should we be looking at? Is there a minimum or a number above which we need to start thinking, let's wear a mask?
Well, this is arbitrary because since there's no dose-response relationship, there's no threshold of such. First of all, we relate the concentrations to the outdoor concentration. And that concentration changes. So it varies between the places and varies in one particular location during the day. So let's say in Brisbane now, it will be about 450 outside. So we are looking how high the concentration is above the outdoor concentration. And here it is where it is that arbitrary decision.
Yeah.
And there is a document which we've generated as part of a Osage group where we recommended that if the concentration, that the best practice is below 600. If, however, the concentration reaches 800, it is an action level, means action needs to be taken. And then if it goes to 1,500, means that the risk is high. And I'm stressing that these are arbitrary values, but it's a starting point. And
Lydia, thank you so much.
Working towards our better future, that's what's driving me and my colleagues. It's not just COVID, it's for our future, for against everyday's cold, blues, and so on.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.